Welcome to Communion and Shalom.
In this podcast, we are exploring how the biblical and historic Christian faith can engage sexuality, ethnicity, culture, and our local communities as we pursue the flourishing of God's kingdom. Our goal is to engage these topics charitably and with nuance.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Communion and Shalom. We are continuing to dive into the Commons series, thinking about local communities and how we actually build our lives together. Today, I'm really excited to have as a guest Joseph Pierce, as well as to be accompanied by good friend Brendan Johnson. Joseph Pierce is a native of England and is an internationally acclaimed author of many books, including bestsellers such as The Quest for Shakespeare, Tolkien, Man and Myth, Unmasking Oscar Wilde, C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, and many more. He's a visiting professor of literature at Ave Maria University and visiting chair of Catholic Studies at Thomas More College of Liberal Arts in New Hampshire. Thank you, Joseph, for joining us today. Could you tell us just a little bit more about yourself?
Yes, well, I don't know what else to say. I'm a writer of I've published now 30 books, mostly biographies and works of literary criticism. But I suppose the book which is most apropos of the present conversation is a book I wrote about 25 years ago in England, and then it was brought out in a U.S. edition a little bit more recently. But even that was probably 20 years ago. And that's called Small is Still Beautiful. And the subtitle of the U.S. edition is Economics If Families Mattered. So that's a book that's sort of on topic as regards our present conversation.
And what are the main endeavors you're kind of invested in these days? Is it still economics or are there mainly teaching? What's your work like?
Well, I consider myself to be primarily a writer. And so I write on anything of cultural import as I perceive it. So that would certainly be the humanities in a general sense. But of course, that includes economics, which is a branch of the humanities. It's about how we live together as human persons in the human community. So, I understand the humanities in the broad sense of the word. It's how we understood philosophically and theologically. So economics is a branch of philosophy and therefore part of the humanities. And it basically is about how we live together harmoniously and ultimately in caritas, in love.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, thank you so much for this. I loved reading your book, Small is Still Beautiful. It was my first introduction to your work, but I was so excited because I've been a fan of Schumacher for many years, and he feels like one of these well-kept secrets, unfortunately too well-kept. But I was wondering if you could share, like, how did you get exposed to his work? You know, what really, you know, set your heart and mind on fire when you were exposed to it?
Yeah, so as a young man, I wrote a book called Race with the Devil, which is my own journey to Christian conversion. As a young man, I was a very angry, racist radical. And I was obviously motivated primarily by matters of politics and economics. And I was anti-communist, but when I would get myself in arguments, heated arguments with Marxists, they would accuse me of being a stormtrooper of capitalism. And my attitude to that was, well, I might not like Marxism as a solution to the problems confronting the modern world. That doesn't mean that I want the world being ruled by Bill Gates and other globalist billionaires. In other words, a global plutocracy, a global rule of the rich. So of course, Bill Gates wasn't around then, but whoever his equivalent was at the time, we used to call them multinational corporations before we started talking about global corporations and globalism, globalization. So I was opposed to all of that. I thought, well, I refuse to believe that Marxism is the only solution to this, what we would now call globalism. So I was looking for alternatives. And that was how I stumbled across Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher. And I think it would be fair to say that it was life-changing. I'd already been introduced to what we might call third-way approaches to economics and politics through the writings of people like G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc. and their ideas, and effectively proto-localism, and the way you liberate yourselves from capitalism is what we would might now call empowerment through the ownership of productive property and through the revitalization of local communities and local politics and local economies. So I'd already been exposed to that through Chesterton and Belloc, but Chesterton particularly is a wonderful writer, but he's literary, where Schumacher, of course, is a trained economist. So he could actually approach these same issues, coming to the same solutions, but in a way which is directly connected to an economic language and economic understanding of things. So that really did broaden my understanding of the problems facing the global economy and politics are both globally and locally.
Can you share just a little bit more about, I mean, what you saw in modern economics when you were young, what you still see in modern economics now, in terms of just how it's kind of tangibly not leading to the flourishing of our communities?
Yeah, obviously, I can articulate more solidly now than I could then. I was seeing through a glass darkly in those days. But basically, that my understanding of humanity is the dignity of the human person and the necessity of the human person, first of all, to flourish through his relationship with other human persons. In other words, none of us can actually flourish as human beings if we isolate ourselves and alienate ourselves from our neighbors. Mm-hmm. So we have to live in community. And we have to live in communion, in other words, in the spirit of loving cooperation with our neighbors. Well, how do we do that? Well, one way we don't do it is to live under a system where more and more of the productive property which we need to sustain our livelihoods are in the hands of people that other than ourselves, and especially now corporations that might not even be in the same country as we're living, and certainly that the people that own that corporation know nothing about me or local communities or individuals. It's all about some mechanistic, global, impersonal way of doing things. And for me, that's inhuman, it's inhumane, it's tyrannical. And therefore, we have to find alternatives to that. And ultimately, the way to do it is to revitalize local communities and local economies. We won't get revitalized local politics until we have revitalized local culture and revitalized local economies. So we have to begin at grassroots and take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense, especially this kind of like rule from without and the kind of, I know Marx talks about this, but kind of the despotism of the workplace when the boss tells you what to do. And maybe that boss is a local boss, but increasingly it's coming from an office building and one of the in New York or London or Hong Kong. Curious, though, one of the things that I find so beautiful about Schumacher's work and your approach as well is that it kind of inverts the priority. And instead of human life coming under economics, which really places too much value in economics and gives economics too much credit for its own vision, it says that economics has to come under, you know, human life and under human communities, and economics needs to be oriented towards the flourishing of persons and towards communities. But a lot of these words, I think, are somewhat challenging, even in terms of the vocabulary that's used, distributism, subsidiarity, things like that. What can you explain something like distributism or subsidiarity? What does that look like in terms of an actual workplace or an actual community?
Well, first of all, these are problematic words. Subsidiarity, they're both ugly words. In fact, subsidiarity is at least accurate. Tributism is just vague, and I don't like it. And Chesterton and Belloc, in coining it, said that they didn't like it. I prefer to use the word localism, but basically, well, I'll go through them one at a time. Distributism, what Chesterton and Belloc meant was not the redistribution of wealth. They thought that would be a consequence of what they were advocating, but it's not what they were advocating itself. What they were advocating is the redistribution of productive property. In other words, that a healthy society is a society where as many people as possible have a real stake in the capital from which they earn their livelihood. So in other words, an economy with loads of small businesses is healthier than an economy with a few big businesses. And even within big businesses, and Schumacher was very good at this, you know, that you can have ownership within big businesses, what in America would be called ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, in other parts of the world, producers' cooperatives, basically where the workers within a larger corporation actually are stockholders, stakeholders in it, and not merely employees of it. Mm-hmm. So this idea of trying to redistribute capital to productive capital, so as many people as possible are stakeholders in the economy. That was distributism. Subsidiarity, on the other hand, is an understanding, the two pillars of Catholic social teaching, and they're both important. We shouldn't see one in isolation from the other. Solidarity and subsidiarity. So solidarity is the common good. All right, that we can't behave in such a way which is going to violate the good of our neighbors. So that's the common good. That's solidarity, right? Being part of a community. But subsidiarity is that things that can be done locally, economically and politically, should be done locally. In other words, that power should be devolved upwards from the locality and the grassroots towards bigger political and economic entities, whereas at the moment it's imposed downwards. You have a huge central government, you have huge global corporations, and they impose their will upon the localities, upon ordinary people, ordinary families, ordinary communities. It should be the other way around. We should only have a huge scale, either government or economic bodies, where that there's no other feasible way of doing it. And even then, you can act. So, for instance, of course, you can't produce a car in your garage. Well, you could, but it wouldn't be very economic. You can't mass produce cars within the family garage. There's something that has to be done. The economies of scale are quite clearly real. Mm-hmm. But in that case, then, what you need to have is, as we said, ESOPs, producers' cooperatives, where the workers in those larger corporations actually have a stake in it. So you still have this subsidiarity. You don't have a global headquarters in China or Germany or wherever that's running the company in the small town in South Carolina where you happen to be living. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea. Subsidiarity is the power should be devolved upwards from localities, the most important locality being the family.
Right now in my own neighborhood, we're still in conversations with the EPA and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And it's interesting, the permitting is all, it starts with like, here are the permits that the US EPA sets in, and they designate, okay, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, you take our rules and try to apply them in your local context. And then our neighborhood is like, do these rules actually, even if they are enforced properly, I'm just thinking about in terms of the subsidiarity of like, what if our neighborhood was actually able to say, these are our needs, can they be met? And that the higher authorities back that up rather than us trying to appeal to the higher authorities to try to make rules that are actually good for us.
Well, the whole idea that one size fits all, and that governments that are a long way from the actual areas concerned can decide what that one size fits all is a reversal and a perversion of a real way of doing things. If you're living in a local community, the people in that local community know what the needs of that local community are. They know what needs to be done to improve that local community for the good of those people living there. But somebody in the federal government in DC has no idea about Minnesota or South Carolina. And so the one size fits all is like using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, right? Is to have this one size, we're going to make that fit everybody everywhere. And that's madness. It's not the way things should be, that the local communities should be solving their own local problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's so frustrating right now that when we bring these problems, they say, well, we have to put in sensors to measure their output so that to see if they meet, you know, whatever measurable levels. And the community is crying out, the fact that we have children getting measurably increased asthma rates because of their proximity to this foundry, why is that evidence not applicable?
Right. Well, again, that's the other thing, of course, is the big government is very much at home with big business, and big government and big politicians rely on big business in order to actually fund their election campaigns. And there's a quid pro quo working here. So the one size fits all is normally not, it's not one size fits all, it's the one size fits the big one. right? Mm-hmm. So the laws are actually made to suit big government and big business to the detriment of the ordinary local per individual and the local community. So it's basically, it's effectively, this is the irony. You know, it used to be the case you had to choose between big government or big business, right? Between socialism or capitalism. Now we have both. We have big business and big government in bed together, running the world to the detriment of ordinary people in ordinary places.
Yeah, that's right. I was wondering if you could talk through the example of like Mondragon, for example, out of Spain. They're a large organization, but they're also member owned or owned by partners who make up the business. How does that model operate, and like how would that be different than kind of the ownership structure of a large corporation today? And like how does that interact with either Christian or more philosophical teachings about the dignity of the person?
Well, that's a great question. So there's a chapter, or at least a part of a chapter in my book, Small Is Still Beautiful, about Mondragon. So Mondragon grew out of a Catholic social teaching, specifically Pope Leo XIII, with his encyclical Rerum Novarum, set out the principles of solidarity and subsidiarity, and suggested workers' participation in larger corporations. So this was what inspired, and then there was a follow-up encyclical by Pope Pius XI, 40 years afterwards, called Quadragesimo Anno, on the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. So these two encyclicals together inspired a priest in the Mondragon region of Spain, the Basque region of northern Spain, to try to put these principles into practice. And this is a very important thing here, because, you know, you'll have, say, free market libertarians and Orthodox Marxists say, well, this is all very well, but it doesn't really work in practice, right? Well, we're going back to the 1930s, and Mondragon grew out of this understanding of we need to make the employees of big industrial concerns stakeholders and not merely alienated employees. Mm-hmm. And he put that into practice, and now Mondragon, a century afterwards, is thriving. The important thing about it, it shows that principles of subsidiarity can work on a large industrial scale, as well as on small industrial scales. There are numerous smaller producers' cooperatives, ESOPs. For instance, a large part of the construction industry in Italy are small producers' co-ops. And you might just find an obvious example. If you have a community of small farmers, they could pull together for the bigger capital investments, right? The bigger machinery that none of them need to use all the time, but all of them need to use some of the time, and none of them have the money to pay for. So they get the club together, and the capital intensive aspect of it is collectively done through this cooperation. But that doesn't negate or destroy their independence, their freedom as owners of their own property, productive property.
Mm. Wow. Amazing example.
It's been a little over 20 years since you wrote Small Is Still Beautiful. And yeah, you know, these critiques, these problems are still on point, and maybe just getting worse, the divorcing from local life. What events have you seen that have they surprised you as they've played out, especially as we think about things in the European Union or maybe things in America that feel like, did it meet your expectations? Were there surprises for you?
Well, I think that there's a natural tendency for those that have power to want not only keep it, but to increase it. So there's a natural tendency of centralization in terms of both political and economic power. And therefore, the those who want authentic political and economic freedom have to be not just diligent and vigilant, they have to actually be active and proactive in fighting for localism. So you know, I can see, before I get into some practical, what we need to be doing, you know, that 50 years ago, it was just said basically the Cold War scenario was stable, and the future basically was that the whole world would be part of either the Eastern Bloc or the West Soviet Bloc or the Free West. Okay, and yet the Soviet Union implodes, and now we have dozens of countries where there was just the Soviet Bloc. So we got the resurrection of small nations, which is basically much better than large empires, politically, global empires. So we've seen that happening. We've also seen growth of an awareness of locality, of localism. I mean, even the word is relatively new. So I do see encouraging things. But the most important thing I'd like to get people to understand, we can change the world every single day by voting. Now, we vote very occasionally in elections, so that every few years in elections. And I'm not certainly not suggesting we should not do that. Of course, we should do that. But we vote every single day, every time we put our hands in our pockets and spend a dollar. If we really want to change the world, every dollar we spend changes the world either in a worse direction or a better direction. So we should be spending our dollars locally on local products, local restaurants, not chains. We should try to spend less of our income on globalized products. In other words, we don't have to have the latest iteration of the smartphone. You know, we don't have to have the latest computer all the time. We don't have to be keeping up to date with all the new technology. We can just be functional with it and basically be controlling it, not being controlled by it. Mm-hmm. So if we spend more of our money on local products and local culture and just go out to local theaters, local restaurants, local distilleries, local breweries. I like fermented distilled beverages. so that we can change the world. So for instance, give practical examples. We buy virtually all of our meat from a local butcher. We buy our produce, at least during the summer months, from our local farmer's market. We don't eat in chain restaurants. So, you know, so we are doing our bit. And if we can evangelize, if that's the right word, we can convince other people that the world will change to be a better place if we learn to, if you like, politicize our dollars, and to actually spend our money prudentially, temperately, you know, in a manner that's going to make the world better for ourselves, our neighborhoods, and our neighbors.
Mm. I'm curious about that too. This is a conversation that David and I have been having for the last year or so, of exactly this, like voting with your dollars and making your dollars kind of build the actual material foundation for the better world that we want to live in. For some of the bigger decisions, like let's say housing, education, even like retirement savings. You mentioned some example from foods and consumable things, even down to like where we choose to work. How would you have any advice or practical tips on any of those?
Yeah, I mean, normally once you have the principles in place, the freedom's in our pocket. In other words, you know, how we spend our money is the sort of society we're going to get. You can apply those principles of localism, for instance, small is beautiful, to everything. So, for instance, we opted out of the global insurance industry. As regards medical insurance, we are members of something called Samaritan Ministries. There's also a Catholic version, and that's Christian in a broad sense, Catholic version called Solidarity. And this is MediShare, not Medicare. And what we do every single month, we write out a check and send it to an individual who's in need. And once a year, so only one check in every 12 goes to the organization for their administrative staff. Otherwise, the money goes directly to people who need help medically. If we, as members, get a medical need which is beyond, you know, our ability to pay, you know, if something really serious happens to a member of our family and it's going to cost tens of thousands of dollars, we put in a claim, and then the people around the country will be sending checks to us. So you've completely and utterly bypassed. We're not spending our dollars to build skyscrapers for medical insurance companies in the big cities. We're sending money directly to the people who need it. So that's one example as regards MediShare. As regards education, of course, I'm seeing now wonderful phenomenon, people opting out of the public school system and starting independent schools, returning to a healthier understanding of education. And again, we have to remember that the primary educator of children are the parents. And it's the parents have the ultimate right, not the state, as to where or how the children are educated. We do not want a big burgeoning central government telling us what sort of education it fits, again, one size fits all, okay? One curriculum across all the schools in the country imposed by a central government. Sorry, that's tyranny. So what we need out there is different types of schools for different types of needs and different types of families who have different types of philosophies. We all have a right to have a different philosophy and to put that philosophy into practice in the way we educate our kids. So, you know, I see now, you know, hundreds of new small classical academies, for instance, opening up around the country. They're one on a smaller scale. These are not schools with 2,000 students. They might be schools with 2 or 3 dozen students. And it works. It's human scale. It's small is beautiful. So, you know, really, whatever you're talking about, Medicare, our health needs, our education needs, there are localist, healthy solutions to the problems.
Mm. Thanks for sharing some of those.
One of the, you know, there's the, you know, this thing about buying with our dollars and, but also of people choosing to, you know, those who are on the business ownership side of things, of deciding to maybe stay local. I think on both the consumer and the, you know, producer or business owner side of things, there has to be a shift of recognizing what type of life we want to live and dethroning the idol of just getting as rich as possible.
Yeah, and there are all sorts of problems there. One of the present share ownership, share investment way of running things ensures that companies, once they're in the pocket of the shareholders, have to be myopic. They can't be thinking about what's the good of the company in the longer term, because the shareholders want an instant return every year on their investment. If you don't give that instant return on the investment, they take their money somewhere else. So therefore, it forces companies to be very short-sighted, very myopic. So we have to think of ways of transcending and superseding ultimately the present shareholding system as a means of how we run the economy, how the economy is run. I'll give you a few other practical examples, though. You wouldn't think on the edge of LA, you know, I'm very much an agrarian at heart. I like to be as far away from big cities as possible. But my wife's family are in Seal Beach, California, so right on the edge of LA County, just south of Long Beach, right now on the fringe of the beast, so to speak. But in Seal Beach, the actual on Main Street, they don't allow any national chains to own stores. They don't allow any development above 2 stories. So the Main Street of Seal Beach is actually very quaint, village-like, and it's made up of local restaurants, coffee shops, boutiques, small stores. So it's like a village on the edge of the big city. Mm. And this is because the local people, that's what they want. They don't want Seal Beach to look like LA. So they take practical actions to stop that from happening, and they've succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like, and this is maybe a question that's larger than for just a podcast interview, but I wonder also, like, people need to organize for what they want. And so I think that that's one thing, it's a question of building power, of organizing, of identifying what is good for us, and then building the power to change the system and kind of devolve that power back to the people who are going to be affected or producing what's going on. Another question, though, that I have is, like, is there a risk in things being too small? For example, my brother was just living in Alaska, and there's a very strong fishing industry in kind of Southeast Alaska, and then all along the kind of coastal Alaska. But they've run into the issue there, as well as I know in the UK and the North Sea, of overfishing. And so let's say, for example, that, you know, Southeast Alaska became its own political unit. It would have no short-term or even really medium-term incentive to not overfish the waters, because that's so much of their local economy. But if there is more like large-scale cooperation, you can prevent some of this tragedy of the commons type picture. Is that just an example of subsidiarity? Like, some things need large-scale solutions, some things need small-scale solutions? Or is there, I don't know, like, it feels like there could be a danger in things being too small or too protectionistic.
Well,
or
I'm not disagreeing with that, but I'm not sure that I agree with the particular example you gave. I would say that if a local community relies very much on a particular commodity, should we say, it's going to preserve and protect it. You know, if they realize they overfish today, they'll starve next week. Then they won't overfish today. So again, I think that the common sense approach to these issues are best sorted out locally. You know, you're not going to, you know, destroy your own livelihood by abusing things. And it is normally overfishing is the industrial approach to fishing. When you, instead of the small trawlers, you have these vacuum things that just basically just suck up everything in their path. It's industrialized fishing, which has led to overfishing, not small fishing communities and small fishing industries. So again, the problem is caused by bigness. Same thing with agriculture, right? The poisoning of the soil has been caused by an industrial approach to agriculture. We've actually, the richness of the topsoil has been ruined. So now we have to pump, you know, damaging fertilizers onto the soil because we've created a desert because of, again, short-term industrial approaches to agriculture. You know, local communities don't do that. You don't destroy your local environment in order to get a living.
Do you have any examples, or maybe in your own life, where pushing for this localism, it's kind of like addressing, yes, these big picture ideas, but also just is actually developing that community where people are actually happier to be working and organizing with their neighbors, with their local communities?
Yeah, I see it happening. I mean, for instance, when we moved, we live in South Carolina, in the upstate of South Carolina. When we moved here in 2006, our nearest town was sort of out in the countryside, about 5 miles away, and it was a ghost town. There was nothing there. It was an old railway town. The railway wasn't there any longer, and nearly all the stores, shop fronts on Main Street were boarded up. It was very run down. Now it's revitalized, and again, you know, local restaurants, local breweries, local distilleries, boutiques, coffee shops. It's a thriving place now. If you actually go there, the problem is finding somewhere to park because, you know, it's now a thriving downtown area. So that's a perfect example. The rise of farmers markets is another example. So I do see it happening. What we need to do is to be supporting this localism and opting out as far as possible. And of course, all of us, we're all not using our computer at the moment, right? Now, all of us, we can't opt out completely, but we can minimalize. I call myself a techno-minimalist. It's not that I don't use technology, but I use it as little as I can get away with. And I spend more time doing things locally or with local people. We go to the theater, right? We go, so it's et cetera. So that, this, we have to rethink our own mindsets. If we're going to change the world, we have to get off the treadmill as far as possible, or at least slow it down, for goodness sake.
Throw some sand in the gears.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for this. This has been a huge pleasure to speak with you. I'm curious if you have recommendations for where maybe listeners who haven't heard of Schumacher before, or where should they go in his work, or also some of your own recent work?
Well, Schumacher's classic work, Is Small Is Beautiful. I would recommend that to anybody, even though it was published back in 1973. The principles are as alive as ever. My book, Small Is Still Beautiful, was basically looking at Schumacher's ideas from, you know, more recently, but basically agreeing with him. There's some good writers. Thomas Stork, Stork, if people want to check out his work. He's certainly very, very good. But if you really want to get deeper, there was an economist in the middle of the 20th century called Wilhelm Röpke, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Wilhelm Röpke is R-O with an umlaut over it, P-K-E. So again, if people want to do further reading, then that's obviously what I would certainly recommend. They might want to, by the way, if they want to mix it up a bit with literature and culture and other things, check out my personal website, jpearce.co, jpearce.co.
For those who just want that first step in, would it be best to go to your work since it's more recent, or go to the old Schumacher work?
Mine's not as recent as it could be. I should be thinking about bringing out another new edition. So, you know, I would say mine is not as Schumacher, because I think that one dovetails the other. But heaven forbid I should say read me instead of Schumacher.
It's So either is a good option, it sounds like. Well, great. Thank you, yeah, so much. There, I know, is a lot more we could dig into. And as I'm thinking about, alternatives to stock market investments, how to actually get into local investments, how to continue to reorient our hearts, our wallets, our loves, to be building up these communities. But this was a really great introduction, and I really do heartily commend your work to all the listeners. So thank you, Joseph, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Keep up the good work you're doing, because obviously we need people to be getting the word out there in the way that you're doing. So bravo to both of you, and keep it up.
Great. Well, for all you listeners, you are welcome to stick around for other episodes. We hit a lot across the different topics, but we are looking to be developing more on the commons. If you would like to see more of this work, feel free to join us on Patreon as supporters. Have a good day, y'all. Bye. Hey, listeners. I want to let you know about the Communion in Shalom Patreon. Joining the Patreon community not only supports this podcast, but gives you the opportunity to listen to bonus content, give input on future episodes, and submit questions for a patron-only Q&A. We're so thankful for the support and encouragement from so many listeners, and we hope that this podcast continues to be meaningful to you.